Okay, so imagine this. You're at a protest and you let loose with some serious, colorful language at a cop. You'd think free speech would have your back, right?
Yeah, you'd think so.
Well, the Supreme Court had to wrestle with that very question back in 1972, a case called Gooding v. Wilson.
That's a classic one.
And it turns out the line between abusive language and protected speech is a lot fuzzier than you might think.
It is. It really gets at the heart of how we balance keeping the peace with protecting free speech, which is always a tricky thing.
Yeah, no kidding. So for this deep dive, we've got court decisions, legal analysis, all that good stuff. Basically, everything we need to unpack this landmark case.
And figure out why it still matters for lawyers today.
Exactly. Now, to really get into Gooding, we should probably start with the story of the guy at the center of it all, Johnny C. Wilson.
Right. He was an anti-war activist, got himself arrested at a protest for, let's just say his language was pretty strong.
Oh, really? Like, what kind of strong are we talking about?
Think along the lines of, "White son of a bitch, I'll kill you, and you son of a bitch, I'll choke you to death."
Whoa. Okay, so that's definitely not your average protest chant.
Definitely not. So he gets arrested, but the question is, was it just for being offensive, or was there an actual law against that kind of talk?
Right, because offensive as it might be, is that enough to get you in trouble with the law?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. There was a law in Georgia, a statute, that made it a crime to use opprobrious words or abusive language tending to cause a breach of the peace.
Okay, I can see how that could be interpreted pretty broadly.
That's exactly the problem the Supreme Court saw. It was like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Meaning the law was so broad, it could be used to punish all sorts of speech, potentially even protected political speech.
So even if someone was just voicing a strong opinion about the war, they could land them in hot water.
Potentially, and that's what the idea of overbreath comes in. The law wasn't just about stopping actual threats, it swept up a whole lot of speech that should have been protected.
Okay, but it's not that Georgia couldn't punish threats. It's that their law was so vague it could snag protected speech along with the really dangerous stuff.
Precisely. To understand the court's reasoning, though, we need to back up a bit to 1942 and a case called Chaplinsky v. New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah, Chaplinsky, that rings a bell. Wasn't that the case about fighting words?
Exactly. That's where the Supreme Court laid out this idea that speech intended to provoke immediate violence, you know, those face-to-face insults meant to start a fight. Well, that kind of speech is not protected by the First Amendment.
Right. It's like the classic example of yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Perfect example. So we've got these fighting words that aren't protected, and then we've got this Georgia law about breaching the peace. How did those two come together in Gooding?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. How did the court see those two concepts playing out in this case?
The Supreme Court zeroed in on the fact that Georgia's law wasn't limited to those very specific fighting words from Chaplinsky. It was way broader than that.
So even if Wilson's words were offensive, did they really rise to the level of inciting immediate violence?
That's a good question, and one that the court really grappled with. They basically said, "Look, Georgia, we understand you're trying to keep things peaceful, but this law is just too wide-ranging. It creates this chilling effect where people might be afraid to speak their minds, even if what they're saying is perfectly legal."
Ah, so it's like, you might not yell fire in a crowded theater, but you should be able to say you didn't like the play.
Exactly. And that's where Justice Brennan's majority opinion gets really into the details. He argued that Georgia's courts hadn't done enough to clarify how the law should be applied, so there was a real danger of it being used to shut down legitimate dissent.
Interesting. So the focus wasn't just on whether Wilson's words were bad enough. It was about the potential for the law itself to silence speech even beyond this one case.
Exactly. And it wasn't just about Georgia either. The Gooding decision sent a message to lawmakers all over the country saying, "Hey, listen up. When you write laws that touch on free speech, you better be crystal clear about what you're trying to prohibit. No more vague language that could end up catching protected speech in the net."
So it's like the court was saying, "Hey, lawmakers, sharpen your pencils and be a lot more careful when you're dealing with free speech."
Right. And the court wasn't unanimous on this either. There was a pretty strong dissent.
Oh, really? What was their take on it?
Well, Chief Justice Burger and Justice Blackmun weren't buying it. They felt the law was clear enough and that overturning Wilson's conviction was basically putting a technicality ahead of public safety.
So they were more focused on the need to maintain order, even if it meant some offensive speech got swept up in the process.
Yeah, they argued that Wilson's words were clearly fighting words and that the court was making a mountain out of a molehill.
So even back then, there was this tension between protecting free speech and ensuring public safety.
Absolutely, a tension that continues to this day and that Gooding really forces us to grapple with.
Well, it's definitely a fascinating case and one that's clearly had a big impact on free speech law. So what happened after Gooding? Did things actually change?
Well, Gooding didn't just overturn one conviction. It really shook up how we think about fighting words. It's like The court was saying, okay, Chaplinsky gave us a starting point, but we need to be a lot more careful about what we label as fighting words, because that label can strip away First Amendment protection.
So it sounds like the court was raising the bar for what could be considered fighting words. Did they come up with any specific guidelines?
They did. Gooding led to a much stricter interpretation of that imminent threat requirement. Remember, before Gooding, just using threatening language could get you in trouble. But after Gooding, courts started demanding a clear and direct link between the words and the likelihood of immediate violence. It wasn't enough for the speech to be offensive or even vaguely threatening. It had to be the kind of speech that, in that specific context, would almost certainly lead to a brawl.
So, like, context matters a lot. The same words yelled at a bar fight versus during a political debate could be seen totally differently.
Exactly. Context is key, and that's a really crucial point for lawyers, especially those who deal with free speech cases. They have to carefully consider the context in which words are spoken, because that can make all the difference legally speaking.
Got it. So Gooding was a wake-up call for judges to be more precise about what they considered fighting words. What about lawmakers? Did it have any effect on how laws about speech are written?
It definitely did. Gooding put lawmakers on notice, too. The court basically said, if you're going to make laws that affect free speech, you better be crystal clear about what you're trying to ban. No more wishy-washy language that could end up catching protected speech in the net.
Makes sense. So instead of these broad pronouncements about offensive language, they have to be really specific about what they're trying to regulate, maybe even requiring an intent to incite violence as part of the offense.
Exactly. Gooding really emphasized the need for what we call narrow specificity in laws that could potentially infringe on free speech. So legislatures can't just rely on vague terms like abusive language or breach of the peace. They have to be super meticulous in defining the exact kind of speech they want to restrict, often by requiring an intent to provoke violence as a core element of the offense.
So it's like Gooding forced lawmakers to sharpen their pencils and be much more careful when writing laws that touch on free speech.
Precisely. It's a great example of how the courts can keep the legislature in check, making sure that laws don't overstep their bounds and trample on fundamental rights. And the impact of Gooding wasn't limited to Georgia. It's a case that's still cited today, both by people who advocate for strong free speech protections and those who argue for reasonable limits on harmful speech.
It's amazing how a case about one guy's angry words at a protest could have such a lasting effect on how we understand and apply the First Amendment.
It really highlights how the law isn't set in stone. It evolves through these big landmark cases that force us to confront tough questions and refine our understanding of fundamental principles.
Speaking of tough questions, we talked about the impact on judges and lawmakers, but what about that chilling effect we mentioned earlier? Did Gooding completely get rid of the risk of people being afraid to speak their minds?
That's a great question, and the answer, unfortunately, is no, Gooding didn't completely eliminate the potential for a chilling effect. In fact, some legal experts argue that it actually shifted the battleground in a way.
Oh, really? So instead of vague laws, now we have to worry about laws that are too specific. How does that create a chilling effect?
It's a bit of a paradox. While narrowly tailored laws might seem like a good thing, they can still have a chilling effect if they aren't crafted carefully. Take online harassment, for example. Imagine a law that tries to target specific types of online threats. While well-intentioned, that law might be written so broadly that it ends up catching protected speech as well, making people hesitant to engage in heated online debates.
So it's this constant balancing act between being specific enough to avoid overbreath and not being so specific that you end up criminalizing legitimate speech.
You got it. It's a complex challenge, and Gooding reminds us that every law that restricts speech, no matter how well-intentioned, carries the risk of chilling legitimate expression if it isn't drafted and applied with extreme care.
Which brings us to what might be the toughest question of all. How do we apply a case like Gooding, which was decided over 50 years ago, to the world we live in today?
Yeah. The world of 1972 was pretty different from the digital landscape we're in now. Back then, the idea of fighting words was pretty much limited to face-to-face interaction. But now, with the internet, social media, and the ability to reach millions of people instantly, the lines are a lot blurrier.
I could definitely see how that would make things more complicated. How do you determine imminent threat when someone's making threats online? Does it matter if they have a small following or millions of followers? And what about things like hate speech and online harassment? Do those fall under the fighting words umbrella?
Those are all really complex questions that legal experts are still trying to figure out. And that's part of what makes Gooding v. Wilson so fascinating. While the specific facts of the case might seem like ancient history, the core principles it established about the need for clarity, precision, and a careful balancing of competing interests are more relevant now than ever.
So even though Gooding was about a very specific set of circumstances, it essentially laid the groundwork for how we think about free speech in a world that's arguably even more complex than it was back in 1972.
Absolutely. And that's why Gooding continues to be such an important case. It reminds us that even when we're trying to maintain order and security, we can never lose sight of how important it is to protect the free exchange of ideas.
It's amazing how Gooding v. Wilson, a case that came out of a heated exchange during a protest, has had such a ripple effect on how we approach free speech, even in today's digital age. It's like this case threw a pebble into a pond, and the waves are still expanding outward, shaping how we think about free speech and everything from online interactions to political discourse.
What's fascinating is that Gooding doesn't give us easy answers. It forces us to grapple with these fundamental questions about where the limits of tolerance lie, how we balance individual rights with the well-being of society, and how the law should navigate those tensions.
It makes you realize that the First Amendment isn't just about protecting the speech we like or agree with. It's about safeguarding the whole marketplace of ideas, even when those ideas are expressed in ways that make us uncomfortable or even angry.
It's about recognizing that the freedom to express unpopular or dissenting viewpoints is essential to a healthy democracy. If we only protect speech that's palatable or inoffensive, we risk stifling the very debate and dissent that drives progress and allows us to challenge the status quo.
Thinking back to Wilson's angry words, it's easy to just dismiss them as simply offensive and not worthy of protection. But Gooding reminds us to look beyond the surface to consider the potential chilling effect that overly broad laws can have on all of us, even those whose views we might find abhorrent.
Exactly. Gooding is a cautionary tale. It reminds us that any law that restricts speech, no matter how well-intentioned, has the potential to be misused to silence dissent. It underscores the need for laws to be crafted with surgical precision, targeting only the most egregious forms of harmful speech while leaving plenty of room for the expression of diverse viewpoints.
So what's the key takeaway for lawyers and law students listening to this deep dive? What should they be thinking about as they continue to learn about the complexities of free speech law?
I think the main takeaway is this: when dealing with any case that involves free speech, context is everything. The same words spoken in different settings can have vastly different meanings and legal implications. And as lawyers, it's our job to understand those nuances, to advocate for our clients' rights within the bounds of the law, and to ensure that the law itself is being applied fairly and justly.
It sounds like Gooding v. Wilson provides a roadmap for how to think critically about free speech cases, urging us to always consider the potential chilling effect of any law that seeks to limit expression. It's a reminder that protecting free speech, even when it's difficult or uncomfortable, is ultimately in everyone's best interest.
Absolutely. As we navigate this ever-evolving landscape of free speech in the digital age, cases like Gooding provide a foundation for how to balance the need for order and security with the fundamental right to express ourselves freely.
Well said. And on that note, we'll leave our listeners with this final thought. If a law could be used to silence the speech you disagree with today, it can just as easily be used to silence the speech you cherish tomorrow. The fight for free speech is a constant battle, and cases like Gooding v. Wilson remind us that the stakes are high and the principles at play are fundamental to a free and open society. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Well, Gooding didn't just overturn one conviction. It really shook up how we think about fighting words. It's like the court was saying, okay, Chaplinsky gave us a starting point, but we need to be a lot more careful about what we label as fighting words, because that label can strip away First Amendment protection.
So it sounds like the court was raising the bar for what could be considered fighting words. Did they come up with any specific guidelines?
They did. Gooding led to a much stricter interpretation of that imminent threat requirement. Remember, before Gooding, just using threatening language could get you in trouble. But after Gooding, courts started demanding a clear and direct link between the words and the likelihood of immediate violence. It wasn't enough for the speech to be offensive or even vaguely threatening. It had to be the kind of speech that, in that specific context, would almost certainly lead to a brawl.
So, like, context matters a lot. The same words yelled at a bar fight versus during a political debate could be seen totally differently.
Exactly. Context is key, and that's a really crucial point for lawyers, especially those who deal with free speech cases. They have to carefully consider the context in which words are spoken, because that can make all the difference legally speaking.
Got it. So Gooding was a wake-up call for judges to be more precise about what they considered fighting words. What about lawmakers? Did it have any effect on how laws about speech are written?
It definitely did. Gooding put lawmakers on notice, too. The court basically said, if you're going to make laws that affect free speech, you better be crystal clear about what you're trying to ban. No more wishy-washy language that could end up catching protected speech in the net.
Makes sense. So instead of these broad pronouncements about offensive language, they have to be really specific about what they're trying to regulate, maybe even requiring an intent to incite violence as part of the offense.
Exactly. Gooding really emphasized the need for what we call narrow specificity in laws that could potentially infringe on free speech. So legislators can't just rely on vague terms like abusive language or breach of the peace. They have to be super meticulous in defining the exact kind of speech they want to restrict, often by requiring an intent to provoke violence as a core element of the offense.
So it's like Gooding forced lawmakers to sharpen their pencils and be much more careful when writing laws that touch on free speech.
Precisely. It's a great example of how the courts can keep the legislature in check, making sure that laws don't overstep their bounds and trample on fundamental rights. And the impact of Gooding wasn't limited to Georgia. It's a case that's still cited today, both by people who advocate for strong free speech protections and those who argue for reasonable limits on harmful speech.
It's amazing how a case about one guy's angry words at a protest could have such a lasting effect on how we understand and apply the First Amendment.
It really highlights how the law isn't set in stone. It evolves through these big landmark cases that force us to confront tough questions and refine our understanding of fundamental principles.
Speaking of tough questions, we've talked about the impact on judges and lawmakers, but what about that chilling effect we mentioned earlier? Did Gooding completely get rid of the risk of people being afraid to speak their minds?
That's a great question, and the answer, unfortunately, is no. Gooding didn't completely eliminate the potential for a chilling effect. In fact, some legal experts argue that it actually shifted the battleground in a way.
Oh, really? So instead of vague laws, now we have to worry about laws that are too specific. How does that create a chilling effect?
It's a bit of a paradox. While narrowly tailored laws might seem like a good thing, they can still have a chilling effect if they aren't crafted carefully. Take online harassment, for example. Imagine a law that tries to target specific types of online threats. While well-intentioned, that law might be written so broadly that it ends up catching protected speech as well, making people hesitant to engage in heated online debates.
So it's this constant balancing act between being specific enough to avoid overbreath and not being so specific that you end up criminalizing legitimate speech.
You got it. It's a complex challenge, and Gooding reminds us that every law that restricts speech, no matter how well-intentioned, carries the risk of chilling legitimate expression if it isn't drafted and applied with extreme care.
Which brings us to what might be the toughest question of all. How do we apply a case like Gooding, which was decided over 50 years ago, to the world we live in today?
Yeah. The world of 1972 was pretty different from the digital landscape we're in now. Back then, the idea of fighting words was pretty much limited to face-to-face interaction. But now, with the internet, social media, and the ability to reach millions of people instantly, the lines are a lot blurrier.
I could definitely see how that would make things more complicated. How do you determine imminent threat when someone's making threats online? Does it matter if they have a small following or millions of followers? And what about things like hate speech and online harassment? Do those fall under the fighting words umbrella?
Those are all really complex questions that legal experts are still trying to figure out, and that's part of what makes Gooding v. Wilson so fascinating. While the specific facts of the case might seem like ancient history, the core principles it established about the need for clarity, precision, and a careful balancing of competing interests are more relevant now than ever.
So even though Gooding was about a very specific set of circumstances, it essentially laid the groundwork for how we think about free speech in a world that's arguably even more complex than it was back in 1972.
Absolutely. And that's why Gooding continues to be such an important case. It reminds us that even when we're trying to maintain order and security, we can never lose sight of how important it is to protect the free exchange of ideas.
So we've covered a lot of ground here. I mean, it's incredible how this one case, Gooding v. Wilson, starting with a guy yelling at cops during a protest, ended up having this huge impact on how we think about free speech, even in today's crazy digital world.
It really does make you think, huh? Like, Gooding didn't just give us a clear-cut answer. It really threw a wrench into things, forced everyone to take a hard look at what fighting words actually means. And then how do you apply that in a world where anyone can say anything to anyone else online?
It's almost like the court was saying, hey, we need to think about this fighting words thing a lot more carefully because it's not as simple as we thought.
Exactly. And you know what's even more interesting? Even though Gooding was decided way back in 1972, the questions it raised are even more relevant now than they were then.
Oh, absolutely. Because back then, fighting words was pretty much a face-to-face thing. But now, with social media and online forums and everything, it's a whole different ballgame.
Right. Like, how do you even define imminent threat when someone's posting something threatening online? Does it matter if they have 10 followers or 10 million? And what about things like hate speech? Does that count as fighting words?
Yeah, all those questions are super tricky. And honestly, it's a little unsettling to think that there might not be easy answers.
I agree. It's definitely not black and white. And that's part of what makes this whole area of law so fascinating and so challenging.
Well, one thing's for sure, Gooding v. Wilson really threw down the gauntlet. It forced everyone to think critically about how we balance free speech with public safety and how to make sure the law is being used fairly.
And that's something that every lawyer and law student should be thinking about, especially as they're learning about free speech law.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Gooding v. Wilson, what would you say is the key takeaway for our listeners? What should they be mulling over as they go back to their casebooks or their legal briefs?
I think the biggest takeaway is that context is king, especially when you're dealing with a free speech case. You can't just look at the words themselves. You have to look at the whole picture. Where were the words spoken? Who was the audience? What was the intent?
And how those words might be perceived by others.
Exactly, because the same words in different situations can have totally different meanings and totally different legal consequences.
So as lawyers, it's our job to really understand those nuances and make sure we're advocating for our clients' rights while also respecting the need for public order.
And making sure the law is being applied fairly and consistently, that's the real challenge.
Well said. I think Gooding v. Wilson really gives us a framework for how to approach those challenges. It's like a reminder that protecting free speech, even when it's tough or uncomfortable, is something we have to constantly fight for.
Absolutely. It's an ongoing battle, and cases like Gooding show us just how high the stakes are.
Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive into Gooding v. Wilson. We've covered a lot of ground today, from the facts of the case to the legal reasoning to the broader implications for free speech in the digital age.
It's been a fascinating discussion, and I hope our listeners have found it informative and thought-provoking.
I hope so, too. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.